We turn now to chapter 5 of Ford's book, The Prenatal Person, chapter 5 entitled The Pregnant Woman and Her Fetus, and I would like us to look specifically at sections 5-4 and 5-6. Section 5-4, the long-term sequelae, that is, consequences, effects of abortion. He'll consider here both the physical, the physiological, and the psychological effects. He points out, and remember that Ford is attempting, although he is completely in line with the teaching of the magisterium, he does not dissent from Catholic Church teaching, he does attempt to put together as much in the way of statistical data as he can to present a balanced picture. And this tends to be rare on this subject, as he himself points out in the second paragraph. His first sentence in this first paragraph, dealing with physical or physiological consequences of abortion: a single abortion does not appear to have significant sequelae or effects on a woman's menstrual or gynecological morbidity or on subsequent preterm delivery in teenage pregnancies. And again, there are a limited number of studies that provide statistics for this. But notice the last sentence of this first paragraph: termination during the second trimester performed by mechanical dilatation of the cervix could result in some long-term damage. He then turns in paragraph 2 to the question of emotional consequences of induced abortions. I should mention that there exist organizations in many dioceses and including Project Rachel, which are specifically oriented towards helping women who are experiencing these emotional consequences of abortion, helping them to reconcile themselves both with the church, come to terms with, and in many ways to forgive themselves for these actions. So here is Ford's discussion of them. He points out, first of all, that it is not easy to obtain statistical information on this because of the tendency for people to be very strongly motivated in their presentations, either in a positive or a negative direction, and therefore balanced studies are difficult to obtain. He concludes that the later the termination in the second trimester, the greater the negative psychological sequelae are for the women. And he lists a number of subcategories. And I hope you'll forgive me for simply reading the text that I've highlighted, but there is a distinction, he points out, between women whose pregnancies are terminated medically, who tend to experience more guilt than those who are experiencing surgical termination. That's partly because medical termination of pregnancy, which is usually, well, which is by definition done by drugs, means that the woman is basically dealing with the consequences of this herself at her home. Often there is bleeding for which she's not prepared, sometimes retained tissue, which then has to be dealt with medically. And so a woman is much more aware of what is happening if she takes an abortion-inducing drug than if she simply goes to a facility and has the procedure performed ostensibly in a medically and neutral environment. Notice the highlighted section towards the end of this paragraph about guilt and loss of self-esteem by parents for not having formed a healthy child. This experience is compounded by the deliberate decision to terminate a previously wanted pregnancy. This is the context of individuals who discover that the child that the mother is carrying has some defect. And highlighted and in dark red text, women who terminate pregnancies following detection of fetal defects experience poorer psychological outcomes and acute grief up to 20% even 2 years later, not to mention depression and guilt. Now, it should be borne in mind that this is a very common reason for termination of pregnancy and is likely to become an even more common cause of abortion in the future, as the not described as eugenic, but nonetheless, eugenic emphases in our society become more present. And in the following paragraph, other things that have particular consequences: coerced abortion, someone who is emotionally forced into this, someone who has prior emotional problems, and if they're younger, all of these are risk factors for developing what he describes as adverse psychological sequelae. He describes post-abortion trauma, the later experience of emotional reactions, even devastation, can be provoked by some pregnancy-related events, such as friends having babies, or even by being aware of or participating in political debates on abortion. If we drop down then to the next paragraph, he reminds us that the adverse sequelae are not necessarily just short-term. It's not a matter of a brief period of depression for quite a number of individuals. In about 10% of cases, these adverse sequelae are long-term and can particularly be the case if the person has some sort of emotional trouble or a history of psychiatric illness beforehand. He points out that the risk of harm is greater among younger women, those with poor social support, those from sociocultural groups that are opposed to abortion, and he points out, and this is highlighted in white with a dark red text, that in a Finnish study, the suicide rate after an induced abortion was 3 times greater than the general suicide rate for women aged 15 to 49 years. And there was a conclusion in this study that there may be common risk factors for both suicide and induced abortion, or that abortion may have harmful effects on mental health. And again, this was a Finnish study, and in Finnish culture in general, there would not have been a strong social or religious opposition to abortion, strictly speaking. He then points out something that I will have us come back to again in the next section, and that is that the full implications of abortion for a woman may not become apparent until she has experienced a pregnancy to term. The effect of actually carrying a pregnancy to term, of having children, has a significant effect on women, changes many women's attitudes towards abortion, and of course, towards their own actions if they've had abortions in the past. If we could now skip over the next section, the fetus with anencephaly, you're certainly welcome to read this and reflect on this question. It is a very important and sometimes rather difficult question. Parents who discover that they have a child with this unfortunate anomaly, which always results in the death of the infant, sometimes before delivery, but then certainly within a short time after delivery. He talks about the various things that can be done, the various forms of care that can be offered, and both to the parents and then the potential for, in some cases, performing an induced delivery, never an abortion, of course. And if we drop down to number 5.6, this is ethical evaluation of issues during pregnancy, and section what I've labeled 5.6.1 is his attempt at a dispassionate discussion of reasons in favor of abortion. You're free to look at this. We won't look at it in detail. But he points out, and this is the thing that I wanted us to be aware of, many women don't believe abortion is immoral before they have become mothers themselves. So there's a significant difference if one asks or does a poll on women who have not yet become pregnant and those who have. And he points out also, and this is something that we'll be noticing particularly in the last portion of this section of our course, abortion is perceived by some as an issue of women's reproductive rights and no longer a remedy for rape or a matter of saving the mother's life. So it is becoming in the social discourse, the general moral malaise of our culture. Abortion is becoming very much an issue of rights and not so much a question of a tragic necessity, which is a rather horrifying change. It's seen, as he points out, by some to be a matter of women's health, and it's then decided that it should be only women and not lawmakers, religious leaders, or doctors who make these kinds of decisions. There is then a very interesting statistical study, which I must admit doesn't jive at all, really, with my own limited clinical experience during my training and years of practicing obstetrics in the context of a primary care practice. This is highlighted in yellow. Research shows that of 30 primogravid women, that is women who were having their first pregnancy, who wanted their pregnancies to go to term. So these are women who are not speculating on abortion, but who want to deliver their babies. Most did not recognize their fetuses as persons early in pregnancy, and only referred to the fetus as their baby in the third trimester. And he goes on to say, in fact, up to 8 to 12 weeks gestation, 70% did not believe that the fetus was a real person. One wonders exactly what language was being used on the questionnaire that was used to obtain this data, what was being said to the individuals, to the pregnant women who were a part of this study. And again, it was a study of only 30 women. It would be also interesting to note where they came from, what their context was. By 18 to 22 weeks gestation, especially after quickening, after the woman was aware of fetal movement, perceptions changed. 63% said that the fetus was a real person, and by 36 weeks, by the time of the infant being capable of surviving delivery, whenever it would, from that point onwards, 92% believed that the fetus was a person. Well, let me say that my own experience as a physician was rather different from this. I encountered women who were seriously considering terminating their pregnancies, and I took care of quite a number of pregnant women and delivered quite a few infants as a part of my own early practice. And I have to say, I never encountered a woman who did not know that what she was carrying was human life. That is, she did not need to be convinced that this was a human being. What she needed was reassurance about the availability of support. In many cases, some of these women felt abandoned, felt that there would be no one to take care of them, were very concerned about their social context, simply did not know what to do. But I did not encounter women who out and out felt that what they were carrying was not, in fact, a human being. Now, this represents practice in the late 70s and early 80s, and so perhaps things have changed socially. That may well be the case. But, again, this is the data that Ford was able to come up with. And then if we drop down finally to number 5.6.2, reasons opposed to direct abortion, we've already reflected on most of these looking at our magisterial documents, but I've highlighted in white the section that he points out it's anomalous that the value of the life of a fetus should depend on the choice of the mother and or father. The fetus is defenseless, totally dependent on the mother for support and survival. And he gives the example of Janet Podell, a former pro-choice feminist who changed her mind after having her first child. And this is the important thing. After having a child, and one might add parenthetically, that the number of physicians who perform abortions, and especially if who perform later abortions, is not as high as people would imagine and tends to decrease over time, especially as they have the experience of performing a procedure that is intended to take the life in one operating theater while in the very next place no efforts are being spared to try to save the life of an infant at approximately the same gestational age. But that's a parenthetical comment on my part. He goes on to quote Ms. Podell saying it was impossible to ignore the plain fact that this baby was the same living being who had been kicking me in the ribs for months. His life was clearly an uninterruptible continuum that had begun long before I could feel him move. So here is the effect of one's own pregnancy on women's reflections on this matter. And then the last point that I would like for us to be aware of, and this is the point which has become extremely heated and controversial in light of the health mandate that is going into effect. This is the statement from Ford. The taking of postcoital drugs with the purpose of preventing an embryo implanting in the uterus is the equivalent of a direct abortion. Hence, these drugs are called abortifacients, that is, abortion-causing drugs. This has become part of a heated debate. The current administration does not want to admit that it is encouraging or requiring the prescribing or the permission to prescribe drugs that cause abortion. proportions, and so this definition is not accepted by many physicians and by many legislators who claim that abortion is a word that can only be used after implantation has taken place. But certainly, as the church understands it, and as any reasonable physiological approach to this, which would presume that human life has begun at conception, according to that approach, this statement is absolutely correct, and drugs that prevent implantation are effectively abortifacients and are the cause of abortions.